Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the drug trust when we come back. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values. These two programs encompass the second and the eighth planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's a foreign and alien ideology. Traditional American values are individual responsibility in place of Social Security and tithing in place of the income tax. Now, these foreign and alien ideologies require of us that we violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant. Now, we covet our neighbor's property, and we call that income redistribution. We steal from our neighbors with unjust weights and measures, and we call those Federal Reserve notes. We practice idolatry by signing contracts with these foreign and alien gods that we call government. And we're not getting away with these crimes either. We now pay up to 75% of everything we create and produce in taxes. We live in mortgaged homes owned by the savings and loan companies. We drive cars that are owned by GMAC or Ford Motor Finance. The average family of four has a $70,000 consumer debt. We owe $12 trillion in our national debt, and we're surety for another $150 trillion of unfunded government obligations. Now, our financial institutions are leveraged out to $60 trillion worldwide, and our Social Security retirement system is a chain letter Ponzi scheme. We're living from paycheck to paycheck, and then we've been taught to call all of this prosperity. Well, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status and a better way of life, why don't you call for our free 4-hour compact disc package. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, and it's free of charge. And you can call and order one right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on to the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package. If you can't get it on georgegordon.org, go to georgegordon.com, georgegordon.com. All right, we've been talking about the drug trust. The drug trust is headed by two huge banking families, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds. Then it degenerates down from there. It goes into multinational corporations, of which we showed you in the first program. There are 18 of these multinational corporations located in four countries. They're located in the United States, Germany, England, and Switzerland. 18 companies make the lion's share of the drugs that we consume around the world. And this is a monopoly. This monopoly is aided and abetted by governments, not just the four governments involved, but governments around the world that all profit from the consumption of these drugs by the peoples of their countries. These drugs and the consumption of it is called witchcraft in the Bible, and this witchcraft over here has a penalty. It has a built-in penalty from witchcraft, which ultimately ends in death. There's a way that seems right to a man, but the ends thereof are the ways of death. So in the book, Murder by Injection, written by Eustace Mullins, he calls it the story of the medical conspiracy against America. These are 18 companies worldwide in scope that are against you, the consumer. You believe that they're there to help. And like any con man, they pose as your benefactors. They tell you, we're just here to help. We're from the government, and we're here to help. What can we do for you? But the reality is, they're there to kill you. They're there to profit off of you. They are there to harm you. Now, they may not overtly declare, we're going to do these things to you. We're not going to harm you, hurt you. We're not going to kill you. But that's the ultimate end of it. We're really just here to make a profit. But if in the process you get killed, well, then that's the breaks of the game. Now, in 1975, investigators found that two widely prescribed drugs, Addictone and Flagyl, produced by G.D. Searle Company, caused cancer in test animals. They had annual sales of $17 million a year, and the firm had given the Food and Drug Administration fraudulent data, and then they destroyed the records of tumors in mice caused by these drugs. Pause. Now, what do you think these people at the G.D. Searle Company did? Here's scientists. Educated, college-degreed people. Here's the CEO of the company, the board of directors, executives in charge of research and development. All of these people have college degrees, all educated. And then they took the data from the mice that had died of tumors, and they destroyed it, and then they submitted fraudulent data to the FDA. What do you suppose their purpose in doing that was? Was it because they loved you? Was it because they wanted to help you and serve you? Now, a consumer's protective message issued from Washington on March 15, 1962, noted that since 1938, manufacturers had to demonstrate the efficacy of a medicine to the government before marketing that medicine. However, the regulation contained a significant loophole. There was no stated requirement for a demonstration of its efficacy or to furnish evidence that the drug will live up to its claim on its label. The message stated, quote, there is no way of measuring the needless suffering, the money innocently squandered, and the protraction of illnesses resulting from the use of such inefficient and ineffective drugs. In 1962, Congress enacted the Kefauver-Harris Amendments requiring evidence of efficacy. The evidence was to be judged by the Food and Drug Administration, the Bureau of Medicine, but the post of chief of that bureau was vacant because Boyce Pilot Jones, Special Assistant for Medical Affairs at the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, blocked the appointment of Dr. Charles D. May, a distinguished physician who had testified at the Kefauver hearings on the methods of the pharmaceutical manufacturers in promoting prescription drugs. Dr. May had testified that the payola, that's called bribes, the payola and other promotions amounted to 3.5 times as much as the cost of all of the educational programs in our medical schools. Let me pause here for a moment. So here's Dr. May, testifies to the committee. And then he says that just the bribes alone from the pharmaceutical industry amounts to more money being paid to the medical doctors to promote these drugs than all of the money that we spent training these medical doctors to start with in all of our medical colleges and universities. 3 times as much. Just in graft. What do you suppose that's all about? Is that because these people love you, because they want to serve you and help you? They're humanitarian? Or is it because they're greedy, conniving, monopolists, and that they are criminals? What's the story telling there? Now, Jones won the confidence of the pharmaceutical industry by blocking the appointment of Dr. May, and according to a report in Drug Research Reports in June of 1964, instead of Dr. May, Jones chose Dr. Joseph H. Sedesk, Jr., who did everything he could to thwart the efficacy legislation according to testimony before the Senate Committee on Government Operations. All right, so we got rid of Dr. May, who exposed the bribery and the corruption. And then Jones, who's a political appointee back in the Kennedy administration, appoints this guy, whose name was Sedusk, S-A-D-U-S-K, who did everything he could to thwart the efficacy legislation. Doesn't that remind you of the more recent, we're trying to do everything we can to block legislation that would require that food have labeled GMOs on the label? What the hell is that all about? Isn't that more graft and corruption? And isn't that being promoted by our government and the food industry? Aren't the two of them in bed together? Sedesk later became a vice president of Parke-Davis. Sedesk had prevented the recall of Parke-Davis antibiotic drug, which had resulted in blood toxicity and leukopenia, before he was offered the vice presidency of Parke-Davis. He was succeeded as medical director of the FDA by Dr. Joseph M. Pisani at the Bureau of Medicine. Pisani left to work for the Proprietary Association of Drug Manufacturers. The next head of the Bureau of Medicine later became a top executive at Hoffman LaRoche. Dr. Howard Cohn, former head of the FDA Medical Evaluation Board, was offered a Joan at Seba Geigy, which he accepted. Dr. Harold Anderson, chief of the FDA Drug Division, was given a job with Winthrop Drug Company. Morris Yakowitz found that his expertise at FDA made him eligible for a job at SmithKline and French drug firm. Alan E. Rayfield, who had been director of regulatory compliance, accepted a position with Richardson Merrill Incorporated. So now, there's about 7 or 8 guys. They were officials at the FDA or at the Bureau of Medicine, and then they later become heads or executives or employees of these very same drug firms that they were in former times regulatory agents of. Now, what's that tell you? It tells you that the pharmaceutical companies bribe the regulators. And then, when the regulators have enacted the rules, regulations, and the statutes and judgments, or they work and they get the legislation enacted, they're rewarded with jobs at these same pharmaceutical companies. They are hypocrites. They are graft and bribe takers, and graft and bribe givers. They are corrupt to the core, both in and out of the government and in and out of the industry. Now, do you think they're working for you, the consumer out here in the marketplace, or are they working for themselves? That's the report. You can take it and believe it, or you can reject it and do whatever you want with it. No, I'm not here to tell you what to do with the information. I just want to tell you this is what's going on. Now, this is back in the 1960s. Now, do you think that things have cleaned up? Did you think that since the Kennedy administration, that the Johnson administration cleaned that up? Or maybe the Nixon and Ford or the Carter and Reagan administrations cleaned up that mess? Huh? I've already showed you that the mess that's going on today is much worse than it was back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. No, the problem is worse today than it was then, and it's getting worse. Or as they'd say in the Disney film, it's getting curiouser and curiouser, isn't it? Thus, we find that the revolving door has long been a characteristic of government regulations of the pharmaceutical industry. I might point out that these regulators also, the regulators of the auto industry are rewarded with jobs at the big three. Regulators of other industries over here are recompensed by those industries by giving them jobs and perks. Now, I don't know that they're, while they're in government service, they're being given bribes, probably. But don't you think that giving this guy a job working for the company that he was regulating is a part of the payoff for a job well done while he was regulating the industry or regulating the company while he was in government service? I mean, come on, let's wake up and smell the coffee here, children. Now, the Surgeon General Leonard Scheel became president of Warner Lambert Research Labs. FDA Commissioner Charles C. Edwards is now listed as senior vice president of Becton Dickinson, a large medical supply firm. And although it is hardly a household word, it does $1 billion a year in the medical field. Its chairman, Wesley Howe, is founding chairman of the Health Industry Manufacturers Association. FDA Commissioner James L. Goddard became chairman of the board at Ormont Drug and Chemical Company, whose president is George Goldenberg. The previously mentioned Joseph Sedusk, the top physician at FDA after accepting a position as vice president of Park Davis, later was named its president. One might think that these gentlemen had left FDA only to find more pleasant working conditions, which were notably depressing at the FDA. Dr. Richard Kraut, test director at the FDA Bureau of Drugs, addressed the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association in 1976 as follows. He said, "There was open drunkenness by several employees which went on for months, crippled by what some people called the worst personnel in government. There was intimidation internally by people tittering in corners, throwing spitballs, and I'm describing physicians, people who would slouch down in a chair, not respond to questions, moan and groan with sweeping gestures, and this was all reported from the New England Journal of Medicine on May 27, 1976. Now, one may ask why a government department composed of professionally educated scientists and doctors would tolerate such working conditions. The answer is that the medical monopoly wanted these conditions and saw to it that they prevailed at the FDA so as to drive away sincere, dedicated government servants who wanted only to do their job, who desired to protect the public from dangerous drugs. It seems that the most dangerous drugs are also the most profitable because they produce dramatic, easily seen results. Unfortunately, they also tend to produce such dramatic side effects as kidney and brain damage or sudden death. Now, the drug manufacturers are adept at organizing influential lobbying groups in Washington, of which the public remains totally unaware. Some 96 companies, including Dow, Monsanto, Hoffman, LaRoche, and many others, put up $5,000 each per year to support the Council of Agricultural Science and Technology and the Institute of Food Technology groups, which systematically mislead the public about the dangers of cancer-causing food additives. And they're able to minimize and weaken the frequent attempts by congressmen to expose the dangers of many of these additives, and it's all part of the game of public relations. Now, I get letters in here from time to time, and they'll ask me critical questions about why I'm so down on the FDA and down on government, and there are these dedicated servants, public servants, working hard to protect us, you know, one thing and another. All right, this is why. Because that's a part of the public relations program. See, they do the same thing here at the NEA. They put ads on television and they show a teacher in a classroom with children. Everybody's smiling, everybody's happy. Telling us that these children are our future and God bless the NEA and the teachers that are out here teaching your children. Okay, that's the upside. And if that was true, that would be wonderful, but that isn't what's coming out of our schools. We've got children that come out of our schools and they can't read the diploma that they're being handed. What the hell is that all about? Functional illiterates coming out of our education system. I was watching Leno the other night, and Jay Leno had a young woman on there, probably a college girl. There was a flag up there on a pole flapping in the breeze, and he said to this young woman, he said, "How many stars are on that flag?" And the woman answered, "I can't count them. The flag is waving too much." It was an American flag. You mean to tell me that an American doesn't know that there's 50 stars in the American flag and 13 stripes? I'm like, come on. What color is the American flag? It's red, white, and blue. Who doesn't know that? Well, this young woman didn't. She graduated from high school. She's in college. Probably has a college degree. All right, now that's the kind of crap that comes out of our public education system, and we're supposed to pay $500 billion a year and then laud the fools that we call teachers and say, hey, that's wonderful, isn't it? Well, if you believe the public relations program, yeah, it's all wonderful and everything's fine until you ask somebody how many stars there are in the American flag, and they don't know. They don't know. What do you think would happen if they were to ask that same young woman, you know, can you tell me where the Panama Canal is located or the Great Wall of China? Leno asked that of a couple of guys there. You see, well, it was one guy. He said, can you tell us where the Great Wall of China is located? And the guy hemmed and hawed and stammered around, and Leno gave him a hint. He said, the Great Wall of China. The Great Wall of China. And the guy looked at him and he said, is it located in China? And Leno said, yeah, you're right. Yeah, you got that right. It's located in China. After he coached him, he could come up and say, well, is it located in China? Hell, the guy didn't know. He was asking Leno, is it? Leno said, yeah, it's located in China. He said, now, can you tell us where the Panama Canal is located? And the guy says, in China? Now, you know, these people have high school diplomas. These people have college degrees, for crying out loud. And you're supposed to laud. We're supposed to venerate teachers that turn out those kinds of students? I mean, surely you people jest. You got your heads up the wrong end of your anatomy now, don't you? What kind of nonsense is this? And now we've got government regulators over here taking jobs from the industry. Obvious bribery is what that boils down to. So once you're in the FDA and you see, well, if you get the right legislation, the right rules and regulations passed, why, this will end up with a lucrative job for you. You know, you can get out of this government service and start making some big money. That's what that tells you. In the 1950s, Senator Estes Kefauver was one of the nation's most influential politicians. It seemed certain that he was headed for the White House. However, due to a flood of complaints from his constituents about the drug industry practices of gouging the elderly and producing dangerous drugs, Kefauver scheduled comprehensive hearings before the Senate on the widespread abuses committed by the medical monopoly. He even called his subcommittee the House Anti-Monopoly Subcommittee. These hearings, held during 1959 and 60, revealed that Schering had markups of 1,118% on its drugs. Prednisone and other drug manufacturers routinely showed profits of from 10,000 to 20,000% on their drugs. The outcome of these hearings was the government recommendations for the promotion of generic or cheaper non-brand name drugs for mass sales of the same drugs at cheaper prices, ostensibly a move to curb the excessive profits of the drug company. The net result was that these companies showed vast increases in their volume of sales with corresponding increases in profits. A more tragic result was that these hearings proved to be Senator Kefauver's political Waterloo. Stung by the publicity and criticism which resulted from these hearings, the word went out from the medical monopoly, which we have shown, is not merely the officers and employees visible to the public, but the shadowy figures in the background, the bankers, many of them aliens, like the Rothschilds from Europe, who control millions of shares of these companies through the practice of street names, concealing their power. That Kefauver is through. When he inaugurated his campaign for the presidency, he found that funds had mysteriously dried up. Without money, his candidacy was doomed. Disconsolate, he abandoned his campaign for the White House, and he later died, some said of a broken heart. Political figures got the message. There have been no repeats of the Kefauver hearings on the abuses of the drug industry since the 1950s. Individual products, such as the current furor over aspartame, may come under congressional scrutiny, but the overall operations of the drug trust remain immune from congressional investigation. And I might point out that this book was written in 1988. In the 20 years since this book was written, aspartame is still out there in the marketplace, and it is being sold in bigger quantities than it's ever been sold. And Congress knows full well that 92 diseases are caused by aspartame, and they're not about to take aspartame off the market. And that's because aspartame kills people, but it doesn't kill them with aspartame poisoning. These people are dying from all kinds of diseases. In fact, one of them is called multiple sclerosis. It mimics multiple sclerosis symptoms. And many of you people out there who have been diagnosed as having multiple sclerosis, you don't have MS. You have aspartame disease. And it's going to kill you. And you're going to love it. You will drink your Diet Coke until you go right into your grave. And the people that bury you will praise the doctors and the medical industry, and they'll say, my God, they did everything they could to save old Bob here, but in the end, Bob succumbed. Now, these people are not your friends, and they're not here to help. They're here to kill you. They don't intend to kill you, and they wouldn't admit that they're here to kill you, but by God, they're not going to take aspartame out of the marketplace. And if you die as a result of it, you know, that's just too bad. It's just the breaks of the game, but business is business. And we're not going to give up these profits just because a few people die from it. And your death certificate is never going to list you as being a victim of aspartame poisoning. It's going to list you as a victim of multiple sclerosis. Now, meanwhile, the drug companies roar ahead with vast sales and record profits on their new drugs. Squibb's Capitin, a hypertension drug, could reach $900 million in sales this year. This is 1988. almost $1 billion from a single product. Merck expects Vesitin, another hypertension drug, to reach $720 million in sales this year. In 1987, Merck had 13 products in 8 therapeutic classes, which reached sales of more than $100 million each. And because of this high volume, the cost of production had dropped steadily for the major drug firms. It drops an average of 15% since 1980. In effect, this has meant an increase in profits of 15% from this single factor alone. In 1987, Syntex reported that 53% of its sales volume of $1.1 billion came from just two products. Business Week on January 11, 1988 predicts another gold mine for U.S. drug maker. However, this gold mine would be nothing more than another dry shaft were it not for the continuing increasing prescription for these drugs to their patients by U.S. physicians. The medical monopoly's weak link is that it's almost totally dependent on doctors and hospital personnel to promote its profitable items. The $18 to $20 million expenditure required to get new drugs through the testing period from 3 to 12 years is not intended to protect the public from dangerous new drugs. It is needed to protect the drug trust as long as possible, affording them the necessary time to milk their present drugs for as much sales as possible before they're replaced by newer competing drugs. It's called protecting the market share. In the business world, it would be called a violation of the antitrust laws where the drug firm's not immune from prosecution under these statutes. So here's the way the game is played. The drug companies are taking money from you, the taxpayers, here to develop a new cancer drug or heart drug. So they develop this with your money. Now, before they get it approved, they submit their own findings. They say, hey, we've tested this and tested it for years and years, and we declare that it's safe. The FDA does not test these drugs. It's the drug company that tests the drugs. And then they submit a report. The FDA approves the drug, and they go up there. Now, they've got an 18-year patent on this drug, and they want to keep this drug on the market for 18 years. If during that period of time it kills 50,000 people, well, so be it. So be it. It's only a few thousand people here. I pointed this out in the last program. So, you know, if an airliner crashed with 356 people on it, it would make the news tonight. Well, yesterday, 356 people died from legal drugs. And today, 356 people are going to die from legal drugs. And tomorrow, 356 more people are going to die from legal drugs. And that's what they admit to. And that's going to go on day after day until it kills 130,000 people a year. And not a one of those people are going to be reported as being a victim of the drug trust. Not a one. Now, you talk about the perfect crime. The mafia goes out and they kill one guy and it makes the news. The pharmaceutical industry kills 356 people a day. Nobody ever reports it. Not a single report. Now, cumulatively, publications like the AMA, Journal of American Medical Association, JAMA, will report on this in a scientific forum. The President of the United States, Bill Clinton, reported on it in 1998. And there are some groups out there that keep track of these numbers and statistics and report on them, but it's in the underground press. I mean, you people out there never heard of it. And it's underreported. The real truth of the matter is it's double that. Double that. But that's what they admit to. Now, this is a crime. It's a crime. And the mafia, with all of their drug connections and all of the wickedness and the evil that goes on with organized crime, is paltry by comparison. They don't kill anywhere near as many people. They don't rob anywhere near as many. They don't steal near as much money as do these legal enterprises that have control of your lawmaking and legislative bodies. You just witnessed the looting of the American taxpayer and the Treasury of $29 trillion. They did it in about 6 weeks with the full complicity of the Congress and the President of the United States. Right in front of your eyeballs, reported to you on the 6 o'clock news, and you people loved it. And you believe in it, and honest to God, believe that there's a recovery underfoot or underway, and that you people are all going to be saved by the very same culprits that caused this problem to start with. It's Public Relations 101. My God, it is a proven winner. It has worked for the past 100 years. It works like a shot today, and there isn't a reason in the world to believe that it won't continue to work for the next 100 years. But I just thought I'd report on it so that you'd have an opportunity to make a choice. Now, meanwhile, back on the farm, here at the halfway point, let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and a biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Here you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the drug trust. Now, as the stock market slowly recovered from the well-planned and executed Black Monday, remember this was back on October the 19th, 1987, the drug firms are more than holding their own, rewarding the astute monopolists who bought in at the bottom of the market. Typical of investment policies of insurance companies are those of Equitable Life, which in 1987 had 7.8% of its assets invested in the stock of drug manufacturers, including $13 million in Marion Labs, $4 million in Merck, $7 million in Syntex, and $4 million in Upjohn. Another 5.8% of its investments were in the stock of the very profitable hospital supply firms. No chronicle of the world's important drug firms would be complete without relating the connection between drug firms and the world drug operation known as DOPE Incorporated. It began with a small group of international financiers headquartered in London who officiated in the setting up of an American intelligence service which was initially known as the Office of Strategic Services during World War II. This organization was set up under the close supervision of the British Secret Intelligence Service and was later disbanded by President Truman, who was highly suspicious of its operations. The OSS then went underground at the State Department as a research group working on behavioral theory. It was led by Evron Kirkpatrick, whose wife, Jean Kirkpatrick, is a director of the Rockefeller-financed Trotskyite group, League for Industrial Democracy, and who is frequently touted as a great anti-communist, the catch being that all good Trotskyites are vehemently opposed to the Moscow branch of the Communist Party. They still mourn the passing of their leader, Leon Trotsky, who was murdered by a Stalinist agent in Mexico City in 1940. Now, the Kirkpatrick Group then resurfaced as the Central Intelligence Agency, headed by Alan Dulles, a partner in the Schroeder Bank, the bank which had handled Adolf Hitler's personal bank account. Dulles' brother, John Foster Dulles, was then Secretary of State under President Eisenhower. Whatever interest the CIA may have had in intelligence gathering soon became clear that its primary interest was in the realization of the enormous profits to be made in the international dope trade, because British fortunes in the early 19th century had been founded in this trade. It was logical that the SIS operatives who set up our OSS, later the CIA, would have programmed to go into this business. It later became known as the Inside Sobriquet, the company, meaning, of course, an enterprise in which one became engaged for profit. The excuse advanced to justify going into this business was that a stingy Congress refused to advance enough money to the CIA to finance its covert operations. Therefore, a loyal CIA agent would do whatever possible to aid the company to raise funds needed for its work. In fact, some of its most active agents, such as Edwin Wilson, suddenly wound up owning $6 million estates in the developing area off the Washington Beltway, a certain indication that there was indeed a lot of money coming in from somewhere. What is the present magnitude of the CIA world drug operation? Well, Lieutenant Colonel Bo Greitz, who has 30 years of distinguished service with the United States Army Special Forces, testified before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, International Narcotic Task Force, that 900 tons of heroin and opium would enter the free world in 1987, the source being Southeast Asia and the Golden Triangle. Colonel Greitz had been to Asia a number of times to confer with one of Asia's largest drug producers. Kun Saw Kun. Saw then said the blame for the world drug operation squarely at the door of some well-known CIA operatives, including Theodore Shackley, who served as chief of station for the CIA in Laos from 1965 to 75. Kun Saw stated that Shackley had worked closely with Mao Tse-hung, who was then the leading drug smuggler in Southeast Asia. Another colleague of Shackley was a civilian named Santos Traficant. Traficant had long been a leading figure in the mafia and had been called before Congress to testify about a possible attempt on the life of Castro in Cuba. When the communist regime took over, the mafia lost an empire of gambling and prostitution in Havana and in other cities. They sought revenge. Traficant was commissioned by Meyer Lansky, the money bags of the mafia syndicate, to get rid of Castro. Whether the attempt failed, or as is more likely, the mafia came to an understanding with Castro about the dope traffic, is not yet known. Traficant then became heavily involved in the Pacific area of the drug traffic, becoming a go-between for the New Gan Hand operation, the drug bank in Australia, and the Golden Triangle. Another prominent personality identified by Kun Saw and others as active in the drug trade was Richard Armitage, whose drug operations began during the Vietnam War. He later moved to the U.S. Embassy in Bangkok from 1975 to 79, and according to witnesses, he used his embassy position to carry on drug operations. He then left that post, establishing the Far East Trading Corporation in Bangkok, Thailand. Armitage was later appointed by President Reagan as Assistant Secretary of Defense in charge of international security affairs, reporting directly to the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger. Business tycoon Ross Perot then learned of Armitage's history. He went to the White House demanding that Armitage be fired. He talked to George Bush, who was the former head of the CIA, who gave him the brush off by sending him to FBI Director William Webster. Shortly afterwards, Webster was quietly appointed head of the CIA. Webster refused to act on Perot's complaints, which opened the door for his appointment to the CIA post. Meanwhile, Weinberger, fearful that the role of the Defense Department in the drug scandal was about to unfold, hastily resigned. He was succeeded by Frank Carlucci, who was then serving as National Security Advisor and who was well-versed in the entire operation. Carlucci personally ordered Perot to drop his crusade against Armitage because Perot's fortune had been built on huge government contracts. He had no choice but to break it off. Other personages involved were General Richard Secord, who surfaced as a figure in the Iran-Contra affair, who had boasted of flying plane loads of gold to Southeast Asia to pay off the drug smugglers. The daytime soap opera known as the Iran-Contra affair was made to order for the secretive operatives of the CIA. They delighted in leading the obtuse members of Congress on one wild goose chase after another, while the real story remained untold. And it was Chief's surprise, a culinary delight of drugs, the sale of arms to belligerents and money well seasoned with political sauce, stirred with various commitments of the State of Israel by leading Washington politicians, and topped off with luscious Swiss bank accounts. In fact, the Iran-Contra affair was the logical culmination of the longtime involvement of the Rockefeller interests and the drug trust in pro-communist activity. John D. Rockefeller himself had tucked the sum of $10,000 in cash into Leon Trotsky's pocket before seeing him off to start the Bolshevik Revolution. That was in Russia. The Trotskyite Socialist Workers' Party, which was left behind to subvert the United States, was operating under the name of the Socialist Workers' Party. It was then given the cover name of League for Industrial Democracy. Thus, the drug trust, while remaining the Stalinist communist government in Russia, simultaneously maintained a communist backup regime in the United States. The Trotskyite movement, in case the Stalinist regime should fail, noticeably irked by his competition, Stalin sent an agent to Mexico to eliminate his rival, whom he had previously exiled, realizing that Trotsky was still too popular in Russia to be murdered there in Russia. So the Trotsky organization now had its political martyr. During the 1950s, it quietly placed its members in power in the media, in the universities, and the government, replacing, in most instances, the incumbent Stalinist hardliners. The Stalinists in Washington, who had surrounded Roosevelt and Truman, were gradually replaced with neoconservatives, that is, hardline anti-Moscow ideologues, who later added to their masquerade by additional and impressive noms de plume, such as the hard right, the new right, the religious right, or in some instances, merely as conservatives. Then, none other than the Hollywood man on the white horse, Ronald Reagan, rode into power in 1980 on a tide of neoconservatism. The Reagan Revolution. Reagan's principal backing came from the CIA, which by then was only a mouthpiece for the neoconservatives, and its house organ, the National Review, whose editor, William F. Buckley, boasted that the only job he had ever had was with the CIA. Gene Kirkpatrick of the Rockefeller Finance League for Industrial Democracy became the spokesman for this new policy, while Reagan's entire team was dominated by the Hoover Institution, whose two senior fellows, Sidney Hook and Seymour Martin Lipset, were on the board of LID. Thus, David Rockefeller maintained close liaison with the Stalinist communists in Moscow, while other Rockefeller interests directed the anti-communist stance of the Reagan regime. Now, this is called Hegelian dialectic. These people control both sides of the controversy. The controversy being political in nature, that is, communism versus the free world and non-communists. The real name of the game is drugs and profit and gain. The people in Moscow are not interested in their ideology. They're interested in the profits that come from the drug business. That's the communists. Over here in the West, we have another group called the anti-communists, who are not interested in their ideology either. They're interested in the drug profits. Now, since these drugs cause so much harm, and everybody is opposed to drugs, well, everybody's opposed to illegal drugs. And why is that? Think about this. Here in the United States, the people who are age 65 and older are taking an average of 6 prescription drugs. 80% of the American people have dabbled in drugs, that is, illegal drugs, cocaine, marijuana, or heroin. While they may not be active at it, that same 80% are active in taking prescription drugs. It could be Valium, it could be some other prescription drug. Now, while we spend billions of dollars in this crusade against drugs, it's really a charade. These drugs come across our border in semi-trucks, semi-loads. Boys and girls, back in the 1960s and 70s, when Bogreitz testified, this is in the 70s now, Bogreitz, he was a presidential nominee of one of the minor parties in the 1984 election, I believe. Bogreitz testified that 900 tons of heroin was going on to the world market. Now, let's plug in 900 tons and divide that by 20 tons. If you take 900 and divide that by 20, that's 45 semi-loads of heroin. Now, this heroin, when you inject it into your body, you're just taking in, you know, just a... It isn't grams, it's milligrams. It's just little tiny parts per million of the drug. 900 tons. Now let me give you another little story. In 2001, the Taliban in Afghanistan had virtually wiped out the poppy production of Afghanistan. Now Afghanistan is the biggest producer, was the biggest producer of heroin in the world up until the time that the Taliban took over. Now since the American occupation of Afghanistan, from near zero in 2001 and 2, Afghanistan is the world's number one producer of heroin again under the military occupation of the United States. And get this, 2006 was the bumper crop of bumper crops. It was the biggest crop ever produced in Afghanistan of heroin. 2007 topped the 2006, 2008 topped the 2007, and my prediction is the 2009 crop will top the 2008 crop. All at the same time, the United States is working mightily. I mean, we are just spending billions of dollars on war and the war against drugs. And we're trying to stamp out the poppy trade in Afghanistan and replace it with wheat and rice. Don't you hear that crap every night on the 6 o'clock news? Listen, we've got Apache helicopters. We've got satellites circling over the heads of the people of Afghanistan. We have billions of dollars, B-52s, the most sophisticated military force in the world. And we can't stamp it out, but a bunch of ragheads, a bunch of poor paupers called the Taliban stamped it out by themselves without any helicopters and without any satellites. Now, do you believe the United States of America, with all this technology, all this sophistication, is unable to do what a bunch of religious zealots were able to do with camels and donkeys, for crying out loud? I mean, do you believe that? Come on, guys, let's wake up and smell the coffee here. Now, the guy that wrote the book Murder by Injection, Eustace Mullins, is no dummy. He's been on the geopolitical scene for a hell 50 years or more. He's got to be 90 years old if he's still alive. I haven't heard about Eustace dying. I met him 20 years ago. He was an old man then. I wasn't old enough to join the AARP when I first met him. He was already 70, 75. So he's got to be 90 or 95 now if he's still alive. And his book, written in 1988, it tells an incredible story here. I'm just reporting, you know, little snips and pieces of what the hell's going on here. The CIA is not in the business of finding out what the hell the Russians are up to with their missiles and their guided missile submarines. The CIA is in the business of drugs, nothing more, nothing less. And their reported intelligence gathering, and I don't doubt for a minute that they gather a lot of intelligence. They've got a lot of spy satellites, and they do a lot of that, no doubt about it. And thousands of people working at taxpayer expense, uncovering what the hell's going on in North Korea and what's going on around the world. I'm sure that those agents are just working their hearts out for the public press releases that, hey, we're here to protect America. But the real business of the CIA is drugs, nothing more, nothing less. It's what it was created for. It's what it does. It's what it does best. And hey, the best part of it is the perfect crime. There isn't more than a few thousand people in the world that knows what the hell's going on with the CIA. Mullins happens to be one of them. Now, a copy of the book. Remember I told you the book is called Murder by Injection. Now, where in the hell else did you hear about 900 tons of heroin coming out of the Triangle in Southeast Asia by Bo Greitz being handled by the CIA? And so I say the book is mislabeled. It's the story of the medical conspiracy against America by Eustace Mullins. Get a copy of it from BraveNewBookstore.com. This is Chapter 9. It's called The Drug Trust, BraveNewBookstore.com. Now, Brave New Bookstore's telephone number is 512-480-2503. That's 512-480-2503. And they're located at 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, 1904 Guadalupe Street, Suite B, Austin, Texas, 78705. And that's where you're going to get a copy of The Drug Trust. It's known as Murder by Injection, the story of the medical conspiracy against America. I remember the author is Eustace Mullins, Eustace Mullins. And the location now is BraveNewBookstore.com. Hey, I've got to wrap it up here and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. Got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.